Welcome back to Epilogues, an unpacking of the weekly Haftarah. You're listening to Rabbi Yaakov Tramp. This week we're going to be looking at the Haftarah of Tazria. This Haftarah is found in Melachim Beis, Perek Dalad, Pasuk Mem Beis, to Perek Hey, Pasuk Yotes. The topic, or the primary topic of our Haftarah, is Naaman's leprosy. We're actually in a section of Tanakh which spends a lot of time describing the miracles of Elisha. Elisha is the prophet in the northern kingdom of Israel, following in the footsteps of his master Eliyahu Hanavi. And Elisha performs incredible miracles, some more explicit, some less explicit miracles that occur at this time. And we're going to be looking at a few of them today. The first one is to be found in the first paragraph of our Torah, which is the last few psukim of Perek Dalad, in which we hear about the unfinished bread. What happens is a person comes from Baal Shalisha to bring the Ish Elohim, that means the man of God, Elisha Bikurim. He brings him 20 loaves of barley and this gift for Elisha. Elisha turns to him and he turns to his servant and he says, go and give these breads in front of 100 people in the town. And as we're going to see in the coming parakim, there's actually a famine which is going to be ensuing later on. And he tells him to give this bread for 100 people. And the messenger of Elisha says to him, but that doesn't make sense, they're not going to be able to eat. So he says, no, there'll be enough to eat and more as well. And that's what he does. He goes and gives these 30 loaves of bread to these 100 people, and everybody is able to eat and there's more. So it's strikingly similar to an earlier miracle which Elisha performed, in which he asked a woman to pour oil out of a jug, and as long as there were pots and pans to pour it into, the oil kept flowing. So the idea of building on the natural reality and expanding that natural reality is something which Elisha has been very adept at beforehand. Just a few points to ponder over here is that it's called Bikurim. The Gemara discusses, is this really Bikurim? And the Gemara says, this is not Bikurim because Elisha isn't a Kohen and this is not the base of Mikdash. But there is a, we'll call it an expression of giving to a leader, giving to a prophet, a leader of a generation, a gift. And this is sort of a Me'ain, a type of Bikurim given to such a person. And in a certain sense, in the northern kingdom, they are living without a Beis HaMikdash because they are barred access from going down south to the Beis HaMikdash. And almost in a similar way to today, where there is no Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara describes in the Brachos of Nun Hayam Aleph that in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, that the one's table becomes the Mizbeach. The way one eats and shares one's food becomes the way one sacrifices as well. Who has one has at the table? How exclusive one's meals are, or how inclusive one's meals are going to be a description of the success of that person being a person who's makriv, who sacrifices. Nonetheless, we move on to the next and the main part of the story, which is really the section which deals with the Naaman. So this is now Perek Hey in Melachim Beis, and we hear about Naaman. Naaman sounds like a wonderful Jewish name, but it isn't. He is, in fact, a non-Jewish king. He is the general of the army of Aram. Aram is the kingdom just to the north of Israel, and seems to be a perennial enemy and sometimes ally of the nation of Israel, the kingdom of Israel. And later on, when Aram is conquered, interestingly enough, by the Assyrians and later on by the Babylonians, the language of Aram, which is Aramaic, is something which retains, meaning to say the conquering nations retain language of Aram until later on, which is why even the Gemara is in the Aramaic, because that region seemed to retain this language of Aram. But nonetheless, Naaman is this general, and it was at a time of war with the nation of Israel. And what happened is that we're told that he is the recipient of tzaraas. He is a person who has leprosy, which obviously is the connection to Parshas Tazria. But at one point in time, there's a skirmish with the nation of Israel, and they capture a Na'ara Ktana, young lady, is taken to captivity. She's put under the auspices of the wife of Naaman, who keeps her in captivity. And at a certain point, just innocently, this young girl says to the wife of Naaman, you know, if you were to go to the prophet of Israel, he would be able to heal your husband from his leprosy. And the wife of Naaman tells her husband that this is what this young lady has said, and he was taken by this comment that he goes off and he sends a letter to the king of Israel, and he sends a vast amount of silver and gold and clothes, and he goes and sends a message to the king of Israel, whose name is Yehoram, and says to him, I would like to have a reception with your prophet, and I would like to in order to heal me from my case of leprosy. At this point in time, they're at war with each other. And so when Yehoram reads this letter, he immediately tears his clothes because he believes, he says, Ani lahamis ulahachayos. Am I the one who's able to bring life or death? And it seems like he views this as a pretext for a war, meaning a impossible request, which is to heal him from his leprosy, is only going to lead to the pretext of war. He gets very upset, but Elisha hears about the king tearing his clothing, and Elisha turns to the king and he says, "Why do you tear your clothes?" He says, "Let the king of Naaman come to me. V'yeda, let him know ki yesh navi b'Yisrael, that there's a prophet in Israel." So before we go further, it's a very interesting idea. Here we have Israel offering her services, and their services of spiritual value to the rest of the world, ideas which they're sharing, their life-giving forces. You know, it sort of takes back to the time when Israel was taking Syrian refugees across the border to heal them and then bringing them back, even though Syria was at war with Israel and would not recognize it. You know, the idea of Israel looking after their enemies, even at times of war as well. Now, why is this? Who is Naaman? So it sounds like Naaman, actually, Chida points out, is the person who killed Ahav. So he is very much at war with Israel. He killed the previous king of Israel, and so there's no niceties between these countries at this point in time. It is important to notice that the Radak does quote Chazal, who points out that because Yaakov and Lavan made a pact between Aram and Israel, right? That's the Yagar Sadusa, Gal Aid, which is found at the end of Parshas Vayetze. There is, in a certain sense, there is a fealty between the nations, and that Aram is blessed with good leaders, and Aman seems to be a good leader in general, as well. Why did he get the leprosy? So the Malbim suggests that this was not a physical ailment, this was a spiritual ailment for having skirmished with Israel and taken this young lady as captivity as well. Why would Yehoram be worried? What's his concern? So it sounds like he thinks this is a pretext for war. It sounds like he thinks that there's no way to heal the Naaman, and he's asking an impossible request so that he can use that as a pretext for being a victim. However, what is interesting about this is that in Yehoram's mindset, the king's mindset, he doesn't even believe that the prophet can do what it is that Naaman's asking, which is an amazing thing. Here you have the king of Aram who believes that the prophet of Israel can help, but the king of Israel does not believe the prophet of Israel can help. How many times have we been in that situation where sometimes the non-Jews understand the value of Torah leaders more than Israel understands the value of Torah leaders, and the Jewish community itself rejects the leadership they have, whereas the outside world understands the value of the leadership they have as well. That's what seems to be happening over here. Why would Elisha do this? Why would Elisha go to bat for in this case over here? So the answer is because he is trying to create a Kiddush Hashem, and he'll be able to show that Hashem is all powerful. So let's go down to this. So what actually happens? So Naaman, he receives the message. He arrives in his chariot and his horse outside the house of Elisha. Elisha does not even agree to see him. He sends out a messenger and says, "Here's the deal. You should go to the Jordan River, the Yarden, and dip in it 7 times, and your skin will return, and you will be purified." The king is really angry, and he says, "What nonsense is this? I've been to the best of the rivers in my country, in Aram, in Damascus, and these are much bigger and nicer rivers than your piddly little Jordan, and it didn't help me there." And so off he goes, very upset. But one of his servants turns to him and says, "Avi, my father," in a respectful tone, "listen, maybe he said something right. Maybe you should try this." And that's what he does. He goes to the Jordan, he dips 7 times, and in fact, as he comes out, it says, his flesh was kibisar narakaton vaitar, his flesh became supple like the child's flesh, was no longer afflicted as well. Very powerful description over here. And finally, then Naaman comes back, and his whole camp comes back to Elisha's house, and he says, "Wow, I didn't realize this. There's no power in the world except for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a tremendous Kiddush Hashem." And he says, "Yeah, please take a salary and take a gift for this." And Elisha says, "No way, I'm not taking anything for this." He tried again to convince him very strongly, and Elisha refused. Vayamar Ein. And so Naaman said, "You know what? You're not asking for a gift. What I'm going to do is I'm going to renege upon my allegiances to my pagan gods, and I'm not going to bow down to them except if I'm in the house of Beit Rimon, which is one of their deities, one of their pagan temples. Then I'll have to do it if it's not going to unless it's going to cost me my life. Then I have to sort of pay my allegiances in that way. But otherwise, I'm going to really respect HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Elisha responds by saying, Lech l'shalom, you should go to peace. And off he travels. The rest of the story is more complicated, but for right for now, just a few points to ponder over here is why did Elisha not even walk out of the tent at the beginning? So the Chumash Anach, the Chidah points out that's because part of the problem that Naaman had was arrogance, and arrogance is only healed by being humbled. And that's part of what he's teaching him over here as well. Also, perhaps the Malbim says is to avoid the conception of witchcraft. He's saying, I don't even need to see you, I know what's going on. So it's not like he's playing games with what he sees in front of him. Why is Naaman so angry? So the Rabbag says is that he's been bathing in the rivers of Damascus without resolution for many, many years as well. But more importantly than the Rabbi now points out is that it hurts his ego. You know, like, here you go, and this fellow, he thinks that he's seen it all, he's done it all. You know, Damascus is more rich, and the rivers are bigger, and the lakes are wider, and the mountains are taller, and yet in little Israel, he is sort of forced to do this as well. It's worthwhile just noting as well that in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of this section over here, that the word used to describe he dipped, he went into the river, is in Greek read baptizin, right? So later on, when Christianity will later claim that a figure in their leadership went to the Jordan River and was healed and those kind of things, he's obviously taking it right out of Tanakh, and this is where it comes from. And why would it be that he did not? Why would it that he not accept? Why would he not accept money? So Rashi explains, because otherwise it's the money that is being earned from pagan so worship, which is now being attributed to him. He doesn't want to take that as well. But the Malbim says that no, it's they're also at war with each other. So he's not taking any money because he's doing this for Kiddush Hashem, and he wants to remain that as like a Kiddush Hashem, similarly to sort of what Avraham Avinu does with the king of Sodom in Parashas Melech Lecha as well. When it comes to him announcing, Naaman announcing his renouncement of Avodah Zarah, it sounds like a pretty incredible acceptance. The Gemara in Sanhedrin questions is whether a non-Jew is chayv in Kiddush Hashem, whether a non-Jew is chayv to give their lives to do Kiddush Hashem or not. And the Gemara debates this, because on the one hand, Elisha gave him the blessing to say Lech l'shalom, which sounds like he's accepting the fact that he will bow down to in Beit Rimon if he's under duress, if he's in public, which sounds like he's not mitzvah on this as well. So the Gemara says, well, no, that wasn't considered public. It wasn't in v'nikdashti b'soich b'nei Yisrael among Israel. It has to be that the Kiddush Hashem is done among Israel, not necessarily among pagans. So it might be a little different as well. What is clear is that Haman is renouncing Avodah Zarah, and that's a tremendous Kiddush Hashem that a non-Jew had learned such a thing from a Jew because of this miraculous intervention at the hands of one's enemy as well. So this comes back to a very interesting episode in Tanakh, which relates to the leprosy, which is talked about in this week's parasha. Have a wonderful, meaningful Shabbos.